thing is on. If not, you don't hear me. Morning, I'm Jaap Akkerhuis, one of the three co-chairs of the DNS working group. We have a packed program and a packed hall. And I see two or three places here and two or three on this side. So people might try to hop in to the front a little bit. Okay. Welcome, everybody. And this is the agenda, a little bit small, but it's about the same as in we had on the web. The Skype is Adrian Bedford, and the other session is done for this session by Vesta. And furthermore, this is the microphone etiquette is being. This is recorded and streamed on the web, so please make yourself known and identify on the microphone. And to go for the last bit, to finalize the agenda, we dropped one thing out, and that's Joe Appley about the IDNs, what's going on, and which gives us slightly more room in doing the rest of the agenda. And I see I have another 5 minutes we can skip. And matters arising from the previous ripe 59 minutes. Everybody has read it, of course, and I have either any remarks about that or not. If not, we wait another 5 minutes. And there were actually no action items left of the last meeting, as far as I can remember. And but if we forget something, let us know for now, and then so we didn't. Okay. No open items. The first on the list is Matthijs Mekking sitting here. He's going to report about everything what transpired. Ah, that's the word. Yep. On the ITF with regards to DNS.
So, thank you, Jaap. Thank you, Jaap. So what happened at the ITF, previous ITF, regarding DNS? So the last ITF was in March. It was in a beautiful place of Anaheim. It's got lovely pictures. I got one here. It's this is Anaheim. But of course, we're not there for the beautiful sites. We were for a meeting. And there were two, as you might know, two working groups there. It's DNS-X, extensions to the DNS, and DNS-OP, it's operational. First, DNS-X, four topics there. Support for IDNs, a topic you might know is rollover and die, research that looks at resolvers that has invalid trust anchors configured, and two, document status updates. So, IDNs. There was a discussion going on how to support ID internationalized domain names. DNS gets a different meaning for equivalence if you propose internationalized domain names. Currently, it's just case insensitive, which is equal. For example, the top level domain for Russia, if you write it like this or that, doesn't matter. But Russia also has got a proper, this is an example, Russia's got a proposed internationalized TLD PV, is it, if I'm correct, stands for Russian Federation. And, well, you cannot put that in the DNS directly, this Cyrillic script, but there is a Punicode representation for that, which is this weird string, XN-P1AY. And so now you got two different zones, actually, but you actually want to make them work the same. So how do you do that? There are actually two proposals already. One is clone the zone and twiddle a little bit with your provisioning system, and then if you make changes in the one, reflect it in the other. Or there's a redirection proposed solution that works kind of like dename. If you got a zone here, just redirect it to the original, in this case, a Russian top-level domain. But most of the working group is still struggling with the problem. What do you mean with the same? And what is a name? Do you mean a host name or every name? Does it work on a label level? Or can it be that a name of label length 1 is this can point or act the same like a name of label length 3? So it's still uncertain what the problem is, how it should be solved, and if this is a work for DNSXT in at the ITF. Next topic is the rollover and die. How do resolvers behave if you configure an invalid trust anchor? This came from an incident that was had resolvers configured a stale trust anchor, actually. And it turns out that the resolver's current implementations are quite aggressive. If you misconfigure a trust anchor, it causes the resolver puts trust in this trust anchor, so it doesn't see valid signature, and it tries other name service and tries a couple of times to see if that valid signature is out there. So there's a large increase in the query load, and the responses themselves is also large. So what to do about that? Resolvers need to be more conservative. I believe action has been taken in the software implementations of Unbound and Bind. So they're already more conservative. And it also raises questions, should we have support for more widely deployed 5011 is still automatically updating the trust anchors at the resolver. Or is there a need for a history service for trust anchors so that you can recover from stale trust anchors? There's been a little update in the DNSSEC BIS document. This is technical clarifications to DNSSEC. There is some discussion about the CD bit, how you should handle that, and perhaps some additional text is needed regarding the report I just mentioned. DNS curve was presented there. It's a protocol that uses elliptic curve cryptographics to improve DNS security on 3 levels: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Working group did not decide if this should be adopted fairly, I think, because not many people have read it yet. So DNSSOP was the next meeting at the ITF. A lot of topics there, two presentations about research topics, and a lot of status updates on documents. First one was a research on NSEC3 hash performance. Basically, the question was, what's the worst thing that can happen if you increase the hash iterations? If you have a signed zone, you're using NSEC3, you're in control of setting that number, but it also has effect on the resolver. So how big is that effect? The research looked at different kinds of number of hash iterations, of course, and also different number of key lengths. And the observations were that key length has more impact on the resolver than hash iterations. Also, you need a lot of number of hash iterations to half the performance at the resolver, 150 plus. Well, the authoritative server has more to suffer if you increase the number of hash iterations. At a constant level of about 100 iterations, it halves performance. So this is a good thing. The incentives are well aligned, so that's nice. There was a topic on IPv6 and recursive resolvers. It turns out that if a zone enables IPv6, it breaks a small percentage of the users. Well, this percentage from statistics turns out to be like 470,000 users, and that number looks rather large. So how does do we make the transition less painful was the question there. They come up with this answer: don't let users with broken IPv6 connectivity know about these Quad A records, so they'll never ask for it, and they'll never get it, and never go try IPv6. 5 minutes left, I got told. But I saw there were 20 minutes additional time, so... from the community, they saw this solution and they say, wow, this is an ugly hack, but it might be necessary to make the transition less painful. So from what I've heard of it, it's that Bind9 implemented it, but it's very hard to turn on. It really, if you need this, you need to do a lot of work during configurations, and then you can use it. This is, they want to say with this, this is all but default. Also, PowerDNS and Secure64 are planned to implement this. So if you are in this situation, you might want to look at these implementations. Then updates to the documents. There's an update in the DPS framework document. It's a document that describes a framework and that can assist you if you are a writer of signing policies and practice statements regarding DNSSEC. Small updates because .se reviewed this and they incorporated the changes and they requested that people read it because I believe there is a little feedback going on here. Another document in the DNS working group is Trust History. I mentioned it a little bit earlier, a service to help resolvers recover from stale trust anchors. News on this topic is that there is a resource record type code 58. The name is TA-Link, Trust Anchor Link. And there is also, like many documents, an issue. Should we add text here of the rollover and die issue? Should we make it more conservative? What changed in this document is the lifetime of keys is introduced. So that you not can use this service if you have like 5 or 10 year old keys. You can set a lifetime and then if it expires you have three possible options: no connectivity, no DNSSEC, or you do an out of band software update. Another change in the document is the document follows the 5011 automatic trust anchor algorithm, but if it detects it's not used, it doesn't do the holdout timer described in that RFC, so you can follow regular rollovers. This document, RFC 4641, is an update to the DNS operational practices document. And a lot of changes there, a lot of topics covered. Recommendations for HSM usages, considerations whether you should use NSEC or NSEC 3 in your case. It's got a review of NIST. It's got additional text on switching DNS operators, how you should handle that, and if they are not cooperative. And there's still a bunch of open issues on the website, the links on there. Two major ones are key rollover frequency. Current draft says you should roll frequent so that you have practice and you know how to do rollover in the future. While nowadays the thought is more don't do that frequent rollover, only do it if it's necessary. If you need a new cryptographic algorithm, for example. Also, who's the target audience? Are we looking at the large TLD or the mom and pop, as a quote from the working group, zones? As you might... consider, or... I'm the wrong word, but anyway... DNS operations on these zones are different, so there are different best current practices. Hello. Non-working group. Stop it, Jaap. Non-working group a document. This is a key timing. This describes all issues around key rollovers. What time is necessary to keep keys in the zone, to keep keys used for signing, to keep them post-published. Very technical document. Changes in that, there was a request to describe all rollover mechanism in detail. They did that. They decided to do algorithm rollover in a different document because it's complex and requires a lot of text. And this is rather a fairly large document already. And the decision was made to keep it separate from the 4641 BIS document. That document actually got a reference to this one. The document is adopted by the working group, if I'm correct. I don't recall. Peter?
It is, but yeah.
So, yeah, confirmative. And then the last document in this working group is the IPv6 reverse DNS. It's a document that analyzes possible ways for reverse DNS in IPv6. It does no recommendation, it just lists the possible ways how you can do this. There were small changes, but there was a discussion going on. Should we have the recommendation, what you should do, and which ways you shouldn't walk? And then there's the discussion, if you the recommendation is don't do this, what's the purpose of the document? Okay, I think we're fine. Everybody still has internet. But there was a question and answer section before all routes were signed during ITF. They had a small presentation about there. They showed that the UDP query rate of A is going down. They had no real explanation for that, but they didn't consider it as a critical observation. And there was a small increase in TCP query rate, up to 80 queries per second. So doesn't look harmful. Questions from the room were a lot. A few of them I listed here. There was an issue on the improper maintenance of Trust Anchor, the rollover and die issue. They said this needs more research, and they're going to deploy 5011 to revoke keys. There was a the question of the frequency of the KSK rollover. The route is not going to be rolled quite often. They plan it to do it 5 years. That's around the lifetime of the HSM the keys are stored on. There was a remark on missing statistics for IPv6. And several things, for example, the reply size test server showed there were some differences when the routes going to the DIRS, and they suggested that the team, the root DNSSEC sign team, should have a look at that and if they can learn from that. Here are the URLs you can go to dive more into these topics.
Thank you, Matthijs. Are there any? Here's a question from Dima.
Messieurs, just one remark. It's very incorrect example on .ru and .ref.
I was afraid
because
of that.
Because unfortunately, this presentation will be published. And people will think that we plan to clone zone. It's fully wrong. It's totally different hierarchical.
Okay, sorry about that.
Please correct, because it will be misunderstanding.
Maybe I can arrange to have a different
to correct
example.
China.
Yeah.
Anyway. What?
Well, Just one remark, there is already three proposals for the, well, adiacent zones. And
yes.
The last is one is mine. So.
Yes, indeed, there's the CNAME, DNAME proposal. Yeah, when I was, it wasn't mentioned in the working group, I believe, and that's why I think I.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to mention that because, well, I wrote to the ID after the Anaheim.
Yeah. But
I'm Peter Koch, co-chair of this working group, and also co-chair of the ITF DNS Op working group, and juggling heads here. Less a question to you, Matthijs, but a question to the audience. First of all, we've been presenting this stuff for the last, I don't know, 25 RIBE meetings or so. We really, really would like to have feedback whether this kind of stuff is useful or you would like us to expand on this. There's a couple of documents there that have operator-relevant content, especially like the Quad A synthesis that was really, really controversially discussed at the ITF and also earlier this week, and the draft that Matthijs mentioned by, I guess it was Lee Howard, on the structure of the reverse mapping for IPv6. So this is something that people in this room probably want to look at. Please give us feedback whether we need to devote more time to that. And then for the gymnastics, because the air is draining here, how many of you do follow the ITF lists personally, like reading these lists?
Quick estimate, about 40%.
23.7% or so. Thank you.
Just a last remark before we...
Jari Arkka. So I wanted to add one other draft that was not mentioned in the presentation. It's Draft Simpson TCP TC, I think is the name. And it's actually a submission completely outside the ITF. It's going to the RFC editor submission as experimental RFC, proposing some experimental extensions to TCP to do some optimizations. And I'm mentioning it here because the stated objective of that draft was to reduce load on DNS servers as they have to perhaps go to more TCP as DNSSEC is being deployed. And this is just, of course, just one idea, or I mean, it's an experimental spec. But there's no ITF work around this at this moment. But if the DNS community feels that there's an issue with TCP load or the maintenance of TCP state and lengthy transactions and so on in DNS, then of course we would like to know about that and perhaps start some activity. Yeah. So if you have any data on, you know, increases in TCP transactions or things like that, then that would be useful.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Matthijs. And now we have another report about ITF, but very specific, Ed Lewis, about the registry operation and the IIE, if I remember correctly.
That was more interesting.
And for those people who didn't do it yet, please download your slides. And Ed has his slides twice on the program. Use the one for the session this afternoon because the first one doesn't work. That's
my
fault.
I'm not used to being in the first half of an agenda. I'm always usually left at the end. So used to that. All right. I have two topics to cover. And these are mostly related to DNS in the sense that these are things affecting people who hold information that then goes into the DNS, typically registries, but also registrars and LIRs and anyone else who keeps track of a database and all and so on. So the first thing I want to talk about is something called IRE, which is an ITF activity. It was a BAFA, Birds of Feather session at the last IATF. What that means is that people came to the ITF saying, we have a problem, we have some people who care about it, we'd like to potentially make this into a working group. So it's somewhat in the first stages of being looked at. What this topic is data escrow, and that's basically backing up the organization. Not backing up what's in the DNS, not doing system backups of hosts, but what do you keep that goes into the DNS? And if you have a registry database, that would be the main item that would be escrowed. This is mostly important for if there's a failure of the organization and someone else has to take over your job. If a TLD goes down, we have to transfer that to somebody else. What's going to be taken over there is the copy of the database, but in an escrowed format that could be then ingested somewhere else. The example I have here, if a registrar fails, who had that domain name? That could be who had that IP space and so on. It can go on to a couple of things. The IRE stands for Internet Registration Escrow. The acronym that the IETF was using is rather unusual. It's RYDEIRDE because they actually had two names. They put a slash between it. Didn't really work well with the Unix file system holding all the information and so on. The mail list is at the bottom. And at the end of my talk, I have a list of mailing lists that to go back to. The status of this effort, the official BOF was held at IETF 77 at the same time what Matthias was talking about. I would say it was inconclusive. The outcome was not to go ahead and make a working group, but it also wasn't to not do this work. There are open questions whether this is appropriate work, is there something to solve, and so on. To prevent going into that here, because it's really not so much DNS, I would suggest subscribe to the mailing list, see what's going on there, especially if you have an opinion on this topic. It's best to say it to the IETF channels. If you say something in the room here, it's got to be carried there by somebody. It's much more effective to participate in the IETF directly through the email list than to just let it sit somewhere. A lot of times in the IETF, we would like to know more what's going on out there. It's part of the IETF's job to bring in information, but we really are structured to get this from the audience, not from liaisons or representations and so on. For IETF 78, the next meeting, which is in July in Maastricht, I can't say what's going to happen there right now. I have no indication whether we have meeting there, BOF there, and so on. It's really up to what the community says is a good idea or not a good idea. So really want input from there. Now, the second half, I'm talking about yet another mailing list, so I have no pretty pictures of parking lots. Matthias, you really stole the show there. Matthias, pay attention. So at the corner of operations and DNS and so on, what we needed, for those of us who work in registration activity, I work for a registry, I also work for a DNS operator, we realized that there's no really good way for that industry of registration to communicate. So we create a mailing list. We have lots of good sub-mailing lists for this, like Center Tech has a really good mailing list for that area. RIPE has good mailing lists for operations. But there's no way for us to reach everybody who's involved in keeping track of who's who on the Internet. New mailing list has come up. Unrestricted to membership. It's unrestricted to a region. We're trying to include anyone who's has any kind of input or, I hate to say the word, relevance to the registration activities. The list is the list. It's not an organization. We're not having meetings. But so there's no guaranteed outcomes. In fact, most of the time we're going to point things off to where they need to go. And so the first time I'm going to show, this is the mailing list, the name, and the URL, and this will appear two more times before I'm done, so I'm going to keep going. Why do I mention it here in a DNS working group? Well, because DNS code writers are part of this. What happens in the DNS affects a lot of times the way we do registration. For example, what Matthias was talking about, Matthias, pay attention, but IDNs, how do we make zones look the same? The code has got to, if the code is in the right place, we can operate a certain way. And it goes back and forth. One of the terms nowadays is cost shift all of this through the industry. Who does the work to keep things the same? Code writers, for example, LIRs actually would be really good to have LIRs because we would like to know issues involving the reverse DNS operations. A lot of times we don't get good hands-on information about what it means to run the reverse DNS. Or if you want to run the reverse DNS, for example, like the comments about Lee Howard's draft about reverse DNS from v6. One of the for instances here, which is the question I most am interested in, is how do we handle DNSSEC trust anchors? How does somebody get a trust anchor from their operated zone into the registry that they're part of? If they're in a .com TLD, how do I get it over to VeriSign? How do I get it to my registrar who goes to VeriSign? It's a little complicated. And on the other end, if I'm a DNS operator, if I'm doing recursive service for somebody else out there, like Google's 888 stuff, how am I going to get this trust anchor out of someplace? This little interface really hasn't worked out in the community. We have ideas, we have ways of doing it, but we kind of want to get this beyond the more known examples like I've just said. Again, that number, and I'm going to say it again, so I'll keep going. More recent topics in the list. This is kind of where the list actually has started. The list has been in place for about a month. We just really had our first extensive discussion start in the last day or so, actually. We started with the IETF effort about escrow, and that became a BOF already, so it's kind of off the list onto the IETF area. We've had these topics that I listed here. Aaron has a RESTful interface talking about their interfaces to their registry. IDN best practices is going to be a topic that was mentioned once already, and I think really was something that really is going to come across the board here. People want to hear about events. Part of this is to help us not travel so much. I think later on I mentioned I get 6 copies of Joe Abley's messages already. We're not trying to make a 7th copy, but at least point people to where they can find out information, and so on. The bottom 3 are fairly large topics. Those were the original ones. I ran out of space, so they're just lumped together. And by the way, one person was concerned when I said, who is? I mean, anything to do with database inspection, IRIS, if you like IRIS, and so on. So this list, I'm not trying to compete with other lists. This is trying to augment. This is trying to unify the industry of registration to get everywhere. It's a low-cost way for people who don't normally participate to get their opinions to people who do participate in other venues and so on. We also want to have a place where we can say we've got an issue. And to tell you the truth, my experience in the IETF goes back a long ways, and one of the problems I see is that when we discuss protocols in the IETF, we don't always make sure people who are going to be affected by it know about it early enough. I know people said that VPP, when it came out 10 years ago, started, they didn't have the time or money to go participate to this in the IETF, and I understand that. As a result, we kind of didn't have the best result possible. We have a good protocol, but we could have been better. So I want this list to kind of be a way for people to lightweight get involved in what's going around in the other venues. Down there at Reduce Travel, go green, join the list. Today everything's got to be green, so this list is green. You don't have to travel if you're on this list. And one more time, I'm trying to appeal to the APNIC audience there with the go green thing. So for the last time, these are the list name and the URL for the management interface to subscribe to RegOps up on top. The bottom one is the escrow list. That's an IETF list, IRE at IETF.org, and it also has a web page you can go to subscribe. Or you can do it through other mailing list subscription methods that you're probably more familiar with, the dash request and so on. So, questions? Oh, no questions. Oh, Jim, nice to see you.
Yes, Jim Reeds. Ed, a bit concerned about the scope of this escrow exercise that's underway at the IETF. I noticed you didn't say anything about financial data in the context of registry stuff. Is that going to be in scope or out of scope?
I would say that is probably not in scope, but then again, the scope, since we don't have a charter, I can't tell you for certain yes or no. I would believe financial data, I would probably lean against, but to tell you the truth, it could come into play. If enough people wanted to be there, it could be brought in.
Okay.
But right now, I think for the most part, people didn't want to touch that.
No more questions. Thanks, Ed. And now we have a report from RIPE MCC, so about the well-known DNS monitoring system. And since this is a live demonstration, we really need to do the swapping of some equipment here. So yes, let's do a song. Well, always we need Bert Weiner for that. It's mean, it should be it should be a song to the demo gods, which, as you know, always strike on the worst moment. And yeah. Take it away, Frank. Frans.
Hi. Welcome to my talk. I'm Frans. If you're right, to see no mic.
No mic? Hello. Does it work now?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm Franz Schwarzinger from the RIPE-NCC. I work in the Information Services Department and the System Architect there. And I'm going to show you a little bit about the recent developments that we did with the DNS-1 service. First of all, a little bit of history. We started this in 2005, and the original purpose was kind of to figure out the if clients can reach a certain DNS server. And TTM was then used as simulated clients. And since 2005, a couple of advancements were added. We added IPv6 and we added enum support. And recently we've been seeing some new challenges, such as Anycast and DNSSEC. So but how do we actually measure those things? Well, it's quite basic. We have two types of measurements. We ask for the SOA records, and for Anycast at DNS server servers, especially the root zone, we ask for the ID server attribute as well. We do one measurement per minute. These are done with a Poisson distribution so that we don't measure exactly 1 minute, but approximately every 1 minute. And yeah, this is being done. The simplicity and also the Poisson distribution is done so that we don't interfere with the operation of the DNS server. When we try to re-implement DNS-1, make it a little bit better, one of the first things that we wanted to do is actually ask you guys who are using DNS-1, what do you want from DNS-1? How do you like it? So in last month, we finally sent out the survey and asked people to give us their feedback. And we mainly asked root server operators, our DNS-1 subscribers, but also users who showed interest over time in the DNS-1 service. And if you feel you haven't received the survey and would like to participate and like to fill it out, please come to me afterwards and we can arrange that. And what we asked people was basically three major questions. What do you currently like about DNS-1? Why is it useful for you? Which types of graphs do you like especially? Which types of graphs help you to debug your problems? The next point we asked was possible improvements. We gave people a list of options, what we think we could do for you guys, make them choose so that we can figure out which features we should put some priority, but also asked you, do you have any ideas? And we showed a new prototype interface and asked people to give some feedback on that. And what were the results? I condensed this a little bit. So we got four big points. One of the biggest ones was better performance. Current DNS-1 is a little bit slow sometimes. This is because of the architecture, but I'll address that in a second, how we are trying to solve this. The next point was real-time data. People really want to know if a problem occurs instantly, how can I fix it? And the next two things are more on the user interface side. There is a better drill-down approach so that people can have a big overview of their domains, then go down to the servers and maybe then into the regions to see if it works in that region better than in the other one. And people, especially who are running Anycast at DNS servers, they really want some traceroute functionality so that you can, in real time, click from that box, I want a traceroute to my server over there, and then see what path it takes to that server. So let me start with the first two points. Oh, I forgot about that. Thank you very much for all of you who participated in the survey. And yeah, your feedback is really valued. So now I go to the first two points of this, and I'd like to address those a little bit, how we are trying to do this at the moment. So this is our new architecture in DNS-1. Up until now, it's all been running on single boxes. We had two of them to have it a little bit distributed. But really all the user interface, the data insertion, the data gathering was all being run on one box. Now this is a bit more fancy. This is the future, what we would like to do. And the upper part of it is basically the part where we focus on getting more real-time data. So to have the processing of the data done faster. And this works, we have a control system here on the side, which is basically a message queue that takes all the incoming new data from the test boxes and then dispatches it to the processing nodes. And the cool thing about these processing nodes is that they are kind of built in a shared nothing architecture. So we can at any time add another processing node. They will subscribe to the message queue, and as soon as they don't have any work to do, they will take work from the messaging system. So in theory, we could even plug in my laptop and let my laptop do DNS-MON processing. This is quite nice. Then the process data is stored in round-robin data files on some big disks. And the lower part of this is the user side of things. So we really decoupled this from the processing so that we can have especially high performance on the user side. So we have these plot generators, which is one of the most process-intensive things in DNS-MON, and we can also scale them up to as much as necessary. And we have them behind a load balancer and then feed it into the user interface, which you guys will see will be much faster than the current one. So this was the system side of things. What about your actual user experience? Well, let's have a look a bit more closely at what our users currently don't like so much about DNS-MON. One thing is that they only have those three predefined views. So you can at the moment look at either a server view, a domain view, or a probe view. But people want kind of a little bit more flexibility in that. Another complaint is actually a very simple one. It's quite difficult to find your own server. We have this huge list of servers in DNS-MON. It's quite difficult to find where your servers are. And the performance, like I said, is not always very good. So I'd like to show you one of our first steps at approaching a solution towards that. And that will be in a little live demo. Let's hope it works. Okay. This is how the new prototype interface looks. In the beginning, we get an overview of all the DNS servers that we monitor. If you actually logged in as your user account, then you will get an overview for just your domain. So this is just the standard view that we have at the moment. And then we provide you with this really simple search box up here. So finding your domain or your domain DNS server is simply a matter of typing something. And the Nick AT guys allowed me to show their domain. Thank you for that. So we'll have a look at the AT domain. And we do a little bit of smart guessing here on what you would actually like to see. And please work. Oh, not now. What's going on here? Oh, no. Well, I was clever enough to prepare some screenshots for you. I knew this would happen. But okay, let me show it to you in screenshots. So again, we start here. And then we get this nice little autocomplete box where you can see all the servers for AT or that are associated with AT in the domain. And then you click enter. And what should have happened is that you see this. So a plot and all the .AT servers are stacked up. And it shows you for that for today. If you go further, you can click here on last week. We have a few shortcuts for for today, for the last hour, for the last week, for the last month, to give you a better overview of the time frame you want. And we also built something really cool in here. You can actually type a date or a time frame in here. So if you just type AT since February 2010, it will show you a plot since February 2010. You can also add, I only want to see it from this region, just from this one probe. So this search box is quite flexible, and you can be really fast navigating around this once you get used to it. And if that is not enough for you, you have here a customized plot button where you can actually define the plot in much more detail. On the left side, those things are quite simple. You have the plot type and the date range. But on the right-hand side, that's where it gets interesting. So we have this stack criteria. So what is this? Let's go back briefly. In this plot, we stack by servers. So we want to see one domain, and all of the servers for that domain, they are stacked up each line. But what you can do, you can switch the stack criteria to domain, for instance, and let's say you are you're not only managing one domain, but a couple of domains, then you could actually change the filters down here and say, show me not one domain, but my three domains that I have the authority over. And then you would get a plot like that. And you see the AT domain, the .com domain, and the .net domain stacked in this plot up pretty nicely. And yeah, I guess you can imagine how flexible this is and how much more cool things you can do. I said, I don't have too much time to show you much more of this, but you can visit me afterwards at the demo stand, and I'll show you more of what we have done in here. But that was the demo. Sorry for it not being live, but I think you got the idea anyway. What are our next steps to actually deploy this cluster that we are building in order to allow for more better scalability of the DNS MON system? Hopefully then more probes, adding more probes to it, and especially getting better coverage for Anycast servers. And another big step that we want to take, we actually want to improve the measurement methodology to allow support for new things, such as TCP checks, eDNS0, DNSSEC, or the RFC 5001 NSID, because at the moment we're only doing the ID.server checks, and NSID would be a nice thing to have there for Anycast operators as well. Like I already said, I'll be manning a demo stand outside in the hallway, just around the corner from here. I'll be there all afternoon. You can come to me at any time. I would especially like to invite our DNS1 subscribers to come see us in the afternoon coffee break, so that we maybe all get together at one time and have a chat together about how we can improve things, especially for our subscribers. You can also discuss this on Ripe Labs. Yesterday we published a post going in a bit more detail about how the new user interface works and what kind of plans we have. If you want to get in touch with us directly, you can email us at dnsmon@ripe.net or me directly at franz@ripe.net. That was it for me. Do you have any questions?
I'm Bogdan Petar from Romanian Toriel Domain Programmer. I'm interested in message queue processing system, how it is implemented, the architecture, and the programming language.
Okay. Fairly quick question. We are using a messaging system called RabbitMQ. Okay. And then there's a Python framework on top that allows us the task dispatching. But if you want to go into more detail with that, I suggest we talk in the hallway about it.
RabbitMQ, as I know, is written in Erlang programming language. Right?
Sorry?
RabbitMQ system.
Yes, this
is a high-performance message queue processing system written in Erlang.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And the processes who are processing the queue itself are written in Erlang also?
No, this is written in Python.
In Python?
Yeah.
Is an interface between Python and RabbitMQ?
Yes, there are standard interfaces that you can just use.
Okay. The framework who processes the messages is not written better in Erlang?
No. The framework that uses the messaging system to dispatch those jobs is written in Python, the one we are using. But yeah, I'd be happy to show you that in more detail in the hallway.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
Hi. One more question, sorry. Sebastian Castro, New Zealand Registry Services. Have you considered providing an interface to access the raw data?
We We don't have one at the moment. We are building this. The backend of this new interface is actually a RESTful API that we could also provide to the public or to our subscribers. It is possible, but we are not doing that at the moment. But the raw data is available for download on our website or on our FTP server.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
I do have a question as well. Yeah. Since you mentioned you want to do more real time, will this mean that if I want to DOS a name server, I can immediately see whether or not I have success on the right site?
That is the idea.
That's
no.
The idea.
I think the plan is right now that we will provide the real time data to our subscribers. And I don't think our subscribers want to DDoS their own servers, so I hope this will not be a problem.
Well, thank you. The interface looks much better than a couple of weeks ago. But
thank you.
Any more questions? If not, thank you. The next in line is Anna. And he's going to talk about the operation of the web, the RIPE entity name servers, and other little details like root servers and stuff like that.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Anand Buddhadev, and I manage DNS services at the RIPE NCC. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we've been busy with. First, just a quick introduction to the team. We're a small team at the RIPE NCC. Myself, Sjoerd Oosterdijk here, and Wolfgang Nagele on the other side. You're all invited to feel free to approach us at any time to talk about DNS stuff. If you have any questions, queries, feel free to look us up. The RIPE NCC DNS Services Department runs a variety of services. We operate KRoot, and we have 18 instances of this running in various locations around the world. We also run reverse DNS services. We operate the parent zones of all the address space that we allocate from our region. We also operate secondary ccTLD service for those ccTLDs that are still developing or not technically able of running their own secondary services. We also operate the enum zone. This is enum is a system that allows mapping of telephone numbers into resources. We also have an instance of an AS112 server at the AM6, the Amsterdam Internet Exchange. This is an instance that mops up all the queries for RFC 1918 PTR queries. We've been doing DNSSEC for a long time now, since 2005. We sign all our zones, and we've been publishing our trust anchors on our website for people to download and use. And we also provide internal services to the RIPE NCC. We manage all our forward zones like RIPE.net and stuff. So in the past few months, we've been very, very busy with KRoot, obviously. We've been doing lots of things to prepare for the rollout of the DERS. Together with NLNet Labs, we did a lot of testing of our KRoot infrastructure and setup to make sure that we were able to handle all the extra queries that that were going to come our way, all the extra TCP stuff. We made sure that we were ready for all this stuff by doing bandwidth upgrades so that we could pump out more data if necessary. We also upgraded our name server NSD to version 3.2.4, And this has some interesting options for TCP and eDNS buffer size tuning. In parallel with this, we've also been busy with lots and lots of data collection. We regularly collect all the PCAPs of all the queries that come to KRoot. And at every DERS rollout event, we've been participating in a mini DITL-style data collection whereby we upload our query traces to OARC for analysis. We've also been separately collecting priming queries, and we've been uploading these into OARC so that we could check to see if there were any interesting patterns, changes as the DERS was rolled out. This PCAP data has also been used by our science group to do some analysis, and the results have been published on the RIPE Labs website. And finally, we've been very busy also trying to reach out to the public to make people aware that you know, the root zone is going to be signed and what that means for everyone. We've written some articles on the RIPE Labs website for this purpose. We took the DNS OARC reply size testing code and deployed that on KRoot instances as well. And we wrote, or rather Wolfgang Nagler wrote, a very nice little Java applet that people could download and check to see whether their resolvers were ready for DNSSEC or not. Here you can see a little screenshot of the reply size tester. This is available from the RIPE Labs website, and when you run it, you can select a resolver to test. It goes away and performs some queries, and then tells you what your resolver is capable of. And if you see any problems there, then you are encouraged to make sure that your resolvers are ready for DNSSEC. So KRoot rolled out the DERS on the 24th of March. That was during the IETF. We didn't see anything of significance in terms of query rates. Everything was stable. Everything looked fine. But the one difference that we did see was an increase in TCP query rates. It's nowhere near as big as people might have thought. We went from a background rate of under 5 TCP queries per second up to about 40. I checked this morning and it was up at about 50 or so. So this has no negative impact on the performance of the DNS root server at all, and basically the sky hasn't fallen down yet. We shall find out. We've also been busy with KRoot expansion. Last year in 2008, in 2009, that should have been, we deployed an instance of KRoot in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. And we did this in cooperation with Afrinic. We also intend to deploy a few more instances in the Afrinic region. This is very interesting because recently there was an outage on the Seacom cable, which is along the east coast of Africa, and Tanzania was actually cut off from the internet. But fortunately, because they had an instance of this root server, they were able to resolve local names, and they came back to us and said that they were very glad they had an instance of this root server. And we'd like to do this in some of the other countries in Africa as well. We're also talking to the people at LACNIC looking into possible expansion into Latin America. And people from the RIPE NCC region have also approached us to ask about more local instances in the RIPE NCC region. We've also been very, very busy with DNSSEC. A little bit of history. The RIPE NCC has been doing DNSSEC since 2005. Was probably one of the first deployments. And that was all due to Olaf Kolkman, who was at the RIPE NCC then. So we've got all this old DNS signer infrastructure. It's basically a bump in the wire kind of model where we have our zones generated by our provisioning system and then signed by the signer and then pushed out onto the public-facing DNS servers. These are just regular Linux servers. The tools that we use are based on Perl. And there's no secure storage for the keys. The keys are stored in the file system, and they're not very secure. And there's lots of manual processes in this entire infrastructure, and it's prone to human error. We also roll our keys quite frequently. We roll our KSKs every 6 months, so that's quite frequent. So we want to improve all this. Going forward, we've acquired DNSSEC signers from Secure64. We're keeping the same model, the bump in the wire, so our provisioning system will not change. It'll generate the zones as it does, and these will be transferred into the signers, signed, and then sent out to the public-facing servers for publishing. At the moment, we have a KSK rollover in progress, and we're using the pre-publishing method for this. The reason for this is that there's no simple way to import our old keys into the new signers. So what we've done is we generated new keys on our new signers on 23rd March, and we've published these trust anchors on our website so that people can download them and prepare the resolvers. And on the 14th of June, we will retire the old keys and switch to signing with just the new keys. In parallel with this, we're busy with reviewing all our policies and procedures. We're generating a new DNSSEC practices statement, and we're also thinking about the key lifetimes and whether we should roll as frequently as every 6 months. We've also been busy with regular DNS infrastructure improvements. We've acquired a shiny new 32-bit ASN for this purpose. We're going to introduce multi-server architecture, and this is for redundancy. Currently, we have single servers which serve all our zones. So if there was a failure, then although the DNS is by design redundant, there would be latency in DNS resolution. So we want to take that away as well. These new servers will serve the INADDR ARPA and the IP6.ARPA zones. The ICANN is currently busy with a process whereby these will be delegated to the regional internet registries. And eventually, we will also move all the RIPE NCCs forward and reverse zones into this new infrastructure. Our first site is already operational at the Amsterdam Internet Exchange. And we are planning a second site later this year. We've had some interesting experiences with this new 32-bit ASN, and I'm going to talk more about it in the closing plenary on Friday. So be sure to attend. Just a little update on the Enum zone. Since RIPE 59, there have been two new delegations, Malaysia and Ukraine. There was also a request from Voxbone, which is code 8835100. This request was approved, but the delegation is pending. That's because the name servers were not yet answering, so we haven't actually done the delegation. Four of the Enum zones are signed: Poland, Czech Republic, the Netherlands, and Lithuania. We're also busy with changes to our provisioning system, which translates domain objects in the RIPE database into DNS delegation. Our current software is quite old and has no support for certain features, and we're replacing this legacy software with new stuff. Some of the features that we want to add in this is support for Glue and for DS records for early registration transfers. This is a proposal that's still actually being discussed among all the RIRs, and when it is finalized, we will be making announcements to the DNS working group. We have a delegation checker, which does pre-delegation checks when one tries to submit a domain object into the right database. This also has some features missing. For example, it doesn't do very well if all the name servers in a delegation are IPv6 only. So we'd like to fix this. It also insists that if a DS record is present in the domain object, then this key also be present in the zone. And this doesn't work for those users who would like to pre-publish their DS records. So we'd like to add support for things like these as well. Finally, we've been running these DNS lameness checks for several months now. We presented our work at previous RIPE meetings, and a lot of users came and said that this stuff was useful, but they didn't like all the email alerts that we were sending out. It was too in your face. It was quite spammy. So we went away and thought about this, and we decided that it would be quite nice to integrate this DNS lameness data into our shiny new NetSense interface that our IS team has been working on. So here's a little screenshot. You can see where one has entered a prefix, and there's some DNS issues that were discovered, and these are presented at the bottom of the map. One can click on them to get more information about what the actual problem was. At the moment, we're querying over 1 million zone and name server pairs for DNS lameness, and we find that about 5.5% of these are actually lame or don't respond. So that's not too bad, actually. And these lameness checks are continuous. We run them every month, and we publish some statistics on the RIPE website as well. That was it. Any questions from anyone?
Get me the microphone because getting out might be complicated. Yeah, and then I have a question regarding the separate AS for the DNS infrastructure. What is the purpose? Carsten Schiefner, sorry. Yeah. What is the purpose? What is the benefit of having a separate AS for the RIPE NCC to run its DNS infrastructure?
Yeah, so the idea is that we can have independent routing policies. We don't, if we use the RIPE NCC AS, then we would have to apply the same peering policies as we have for that AS, and that AS has a different purpose. So we decided we'd get a separate one, and also we want to anycast with this. So administratively, it makes much more sense to keep it separate.
Well, there are two of my co-chairs at the microphone.
Yep, Jim Reed. Arand, very interested to hear what's happening with reverse zone signing for ERX space. And I realize it's quite complicated because it involves interactions with the other RIRs, specifically with Arand. I just wonder if you might be able to expand a little bit more on the information you gave. You say there's a project underway. You're discussing things with the other RIRs. Have you a rough feel or a gut feel as to when that may actually be ready, and if there'd be possibility, say, for members of this organization to participate in trials with a new system that will then deal with signing and exchange of keying material for the reverse zones in the ERX space?
So these discussions are happening at the RIR level, and I don't have an exact time frame for when these discussions will be concluded, but I'm hoping that by the next RIPE meeting, we may have something to tell you. But I think Andre's coming up, and he might have something to add to this.
I just wonder if it must be like the DNS second. It'll be done within 6 months.
Andrei Rabachevsky, RIPE NCC, just a quick comment. Indeed, this is being discussed, and that requires some changes in our provisioning system. From a user experience point of view, I don't think, at least for the RIPE region users, it shouldn't have any changes. With regards to timeline, as I reply to the mailing list, maybe mid-year we'll have more accurate plans on the rollout of this service and how we tackle this address space. And that also goes in line, you know, that other areas are deploying DNSSEC. They are at different stages of this deployment, and that also somehow determines the urgency of this activity.
You talk about earlier in your presentation about the multi-server infrastructure. I'm interested in load balancing policy you are employing in this setup. What is the software? What is the technique?
We use OSPF-based load balancing. So we have a router that talks OSPF to all the servers, and they all run Quagga and announce routes to the router. And if we want to withdraw any one box from this cluster, we withdraw the OSPF routes.
Have you ever considered the solution presented, for example, by OpenBSD operating system called RelayD, which is a very strong and powerful tool in not only load balancing at layer 3 or load balancing at layer 7, and is capable of load balancing almost every kind of protocol and the traffic?
We haven't looked at RelayD, but we're quite happy to look at it, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that. But I will add that OSPF load balancing, especially for DNS, works quite well because most DNS traffic is UDP-based. We already use this technique within KRoot as well, and it has worked very well over the last several years.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? I've got small clarifying questions. All this lameness checking, that is only on the reverse tree. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the lameness checks that we're running are only on the reverse tree.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
And our next speaker will be a co-chair. Peter Koch, and he's going to talk about experience of experiments with DNSSEC in Germany. And
does it work? Thanks. Okay. So, good morning, everyone. Thanks for the introduction. My name is Peter Koch. I work for DNIC, the DE top-level domain registry. I'm going to talk a bit about the DNSSEC testbed that we have been running for quite some while. Now, there is a severe warning sign on this slide that you may see there that should warn you that you encounter some of the marketing content, and I'm not talking about my name being present there, but an engineer, of course, would never write .de because we all know that domains don't start with a dot. So be warned if you see these signs. Yeah, here we are. So this is for the marketing content. 250,000 domains secured by DNSSEC. Okay, so now for the reality. Well, this is not completely untrue, which is part of why do you marketing, right? So now back to the roadmap. So what we've been doing, the DE top-level domain is I guess we're back on the top list of the country code top-level domains with roughly 13.5 million domains. And of course, we haven't signed them all. So what did we do? Mid last year, roughly a year ago, it was decided to come up with a testbed to gather some sense of what the customer, the environment, ISPs, the market, so to speak, and I warned you again, is going to take to support DNSSEC or maybe not. So in addition to do some planning and project management before that, in December last year, we started to deploy, or we started actually before that, but we had deployed a separate infrastructure for DNSSEC testbed. So that meant we have two locations, I'll have some details later, giving access to a special version of the DE zone. And in December, we just published our unsigned DE zone there to give people who wanted to participate in the testbed a chance to trim their resolvers to take part in that, published on a separate infrastructure. Then in January, just after the beginning of the year, we started publishing a signed version of the DE zone in there on that dedicated infrastructure. And yeah, we did have these roughly 250,000 domains signed even before we accepted DNS keys for registration, and I'll show you later how that works. And then finally in March, actually March 2nd, we started to accept DNSSEC key material for inclusion into the testbed, and the DNS keys, the subject of registration here, and some of the domains or the zone maintainers actually decided to participate, and we incorporated this into the signed testbed. The testbed is scheduled to run until the end of this year, and now, even though Jim spoiled that, but this is one of the rare remaining occasions of bringing DNSSEC into the same sentence as 6 months. So we roughly 6 months and a couple of weeks to go. Yeah, you're welcome. Be my guest. So some data points there. How did we set this up? We're currently in the process of rolling out a new version of our normal infrastructure with kind of 16 locations, serving three Anycast clouds, V4, V6, and everything like that. But, of course, we didn't deploy the DNSSEC testbed on that because that would have been too complicated and too expensive and everything like that. So we chose to have dedicated authoritative server clusters at fancy locations to coincide or co-locate, I should say, with our registration locations, that is Amsterdam and Frankfurt. And that also has the property that we have nice short RTTs for the participants that we would have expected to be mostly present in Germany and the surrounding areas. We also chose one remote location to have kind of, I shouldn't say bad connections, not blaming our providers there, but to give us some bandwidth delay product to play with, to study the effects of having to transfer a 1.3 gigabyte zone file on the wire a couple of times a day. And we are seeing interesting stuff there. We are publishing a signed version of the live DE zone. So what you see in the testbed is just signed. What you see in on the live infrastructure, just that we don't update that as often. We're using NSEC 3 with opt-out, RSA SHA-256, and there's three products that we are aware of that would be able to participate in this testbed from the validator side. That is bind 9.7 or 9.6 maybe, because unfortunately that nice SHA-56 pack was backported to that old piece of software. It is unbound. We would recommend 1.4.4. Maybe I can come to that later. And there's Nominum Vantio. Zone update or zone data changes. Now again, for the marketing hat, this is updates, right? Happening twice per day on the real infrastructure. We're doing that every 2 hours. That is 12 times a day, so we're lagging a bit behind here. And the main reason for that is not that the signing would take so long, but the distributing of the zone file to that remote location can take a bit more, say, than 2 hours at the moment. The frequency of changes is going to increase during the rest of the testbed beyond the status quo, and that also means beyond the status quo that we have in our real-life environment at the moment. So we are approaching the real-life environment from two sides here, from that particular project, and then there's some improvement coming out of the DNSSEC testbed project. signing details, of course, we have a ZSK-KSK split, 1K ZSK RSA SHA-256, what the root does and what probably most everybody else does these days. Software is based on a Java product. Why that? Our software developers love Java. I love our software developers. So that was the product of choice there. It is also that there was a nice product available or a nice piece of software available written by David Blacker from VeriSign, and we could make use of that. And our software engineers added PKCS11 support so that we could use the hardware Sun/Oracle SDA 6000, also a well-known product in this community for its HSM features. And you have all these fancy buzzwords there. I'm not going to read that. The signing is done, or will be done, I should say, but again, weighing truth for marketing here a bit. We do have two registry locations, and we plan to have a redundant setup in both of the registry locations. That means two signing systems in Frankfurt and two in Amsterdam, and then 2 to 3 cards. We are struggling a bit there right now, SEA 6000 cards per system. Currently, we are running on a single card there that gives us a performance of roughly 1,600 signatures per second, so we can sign a DE zone with 900,000 signatures in like 10 minutes or so. That's going to improve, but since we're in the testbed stage right now, we have ample time to play with this stuff. The KSK, 2K length, also not too uncommon. Signatures are generated in advance, and we're using another SCA 6000 for that. We are not signing let me put it the other way around. The DNS key Apex RR set is only signed by the KSK, and that's also common practice these days. We're using NSEC3 opt-out, using a SALT, and 32 iterations, and that's a bit more than everybody else did, and that's exactly the reason why. We wanted to make a difference here, and not just follow blindly these parameters that everybody else used, because should we have the necessity in the future to change these parameters, then we would like to be prepared and have this tested somewhere before anybody goes into production with these large numbers. And for those interested, I'd like to refer you to the NLNet Lab study on NSEC3 performance that Matthijs mentioned before, and we are very interestingly looking at that as well. This stuff will also be published in a DNSSEC practices statement that is due in the first half of June, I'd say. Hey, the internet broke. Okay. Now for the numbers. I said 250,000 domains. So the DE zone has a property that makes us special. Of course, everybody is special, but we are even more special there. In contrast to most of the TLDs, we are not only serving second-level domains as referrals. That is, we're not only registering delegations, but for historical reasons, we have like these 250,000 domains in there that are authoritative in the TLD zone, which means as soon as we sign the TLD zone, these domains are signed as well. I spoiled the whole marketing. I'm so sorry. But this gives us... Seriously, this gives us some interesting insights here, because we now really have a big zone to deploy. A bunch of crypto noise, so to speak, to distribute, which doesn't well compress, which is interesting if you push this through VPNs and everything like that. So we're going to have like 400,000, 500,000 NSEC3 records. That is due to these authoritative data, due to a lot of empty non-terminals in there. And you see the high watermark was end of April. We're having an interesting pattern in there. Always at the end of the month, some registrars seem to drop some of the domains, maybe an artifact of the billing system, and then maybe colleagues in the billing department want to look at that. So we reached roughly 900,000 signatures in that zone at the end of April. And we're going back to that, and you see that the trend is growing in the end. How do you get DNSSEC key material into the testbed? Well, usually TLDs work with registrars, so do we, and this is also what we do in the testbed. The DNS key, and remember, we are not working on the DS record. We are choosing the DNS key as the piece to register, because that is what the client has in its hand without further ado. The DNS key will be subject to some technical or, say, protocol checks, but then it is submitted into the production database. There is no special testbed database or anything. It's our live production database. That means we had to bump up our registration system. The whole registry interface is DNSSEC ready at that stage. We're using RRI. That's our special flavor. And, of course, it tastes much better than EPP. Okay. Well, you made me silent first time in 2 years or so. Web interface that is also accessing this real-time interface is also DNSSEC ready, so that registrars, either those that do mass registrations or that do that manually, can actually submit stuff into the testbed. The DNS keys will be immediately visible through the registry interface, which is fine for the registrars, but also in the information services, so that when you have a DE domain that you know is signed, you can look it up through port 43 whois or through the web whois. When the web whois, you have to click accept on the terms and conditions and then solve a captcha and then add some spices for the German food there. And then you get access to the domain and you can actually see the DNS key being in the registry. The only difference is that we don't publish the DS records in the live DNS, but only on the testbed. So we'll skip that. You have seen DS records enough these days, I guess. Some prerequisites for the DNS key registration. So we would like to see, we recommend that the SCP bit be set, but we don't really require that because we don't want to require people to have a KSK-ZSK split. It's just a another check to avoid mistakes. We decided that the revoke bit must not be set because nobody could explain to us why it would be sensible to register a or to generate a DS record from a revoked key. We only accept DNS key records with IANA assigned code points, that is RSA and DSA with different hash algorithms. And GOST actually may follow next as soon as we get our hands on the libraries and DNS Java libraries supporting this and so on and so forth. Other key parameters must obey their particular specification, that is, the key length has to be in certain ranges and so on and so forth, and we would like to see the SOA record validated against at least one of the submitted DNS keys. Why at least? Why not all? Well, we heard about DS record pre-registration, and that's basically the same reason here. It allows for the pre-registration of not yet visible trust anchors, and that might be interesting in the case of an operator handover, so the new operator can submit their, or can the old registrar have their key submitted, and that would allow for a smooth transition here. So, observations. Now, you saw 25 with a couple of zeros on one of my first slides. I've skipped all the zeros because they don't have any meaning anyway, right? So the truth is we have 25 zones in there signed and participating. Well, in reality, it's quite double the number, but the other 25 would account for our internal testing zones. One of the zones, and I guess we're going to hear about that this afternoon, is from our federal government, so it's good that the government trusts us, and a couple of people that have been active on our mailing list and that probably are known in the community. We actually have one registrar that publicly admitted to supporting this stuff, and we know of some of the others that are working on it. The testbed is not seeing many queries at the moment, and we would like to improve on that. We are seeing roughly 600 different IP addresses querying, but roughly below 10 queries per second, and that is something in the order that you could actually answer on the phone. But other than that, now I hope the ITU didn't hear that. Other than that, no news is good news, but this is for the part I could actually publish on the slides. We have found some minor issues, not so much with our setup, but in the interworking between various resolvers. That's one reason I recommended Unbound 1.4.4 over the previous versions. We had some strangeness there with our setup that we fixed, and then Unbound was reacting. But that's all fixed. If you look at the Unbound release notes, the testbed is actually mentioned, so thanks NLNet Labs for that extra promotion there. So it has its sense, and people can go there. On our website, we have configuration file snippets for all three products that we are aware of, and of course we also publish the trust anchor there, so you can copy that and go participate with your resolver. So back to the marketing now. 25 out of 13 million, that's of course little participation. But then, again, a reality check. We would not expect to everybody to participate in a testbed or everybody to be interested in DNSSEC in the first place. So it is interesting to look at how many domains, second-level domains or zones, I should say, in DE do actually have a DNS key at the apex. And that's roughly 550. And it has changed over the last year maybe from roughly 400 to 450. So out of these 400, out of these 550, we have 25. And that is, well, not perfect, but at least not as bad as 25 out of 30 million. Next steps, we're going to expand on logging and reporting, and we hope there is anything to report there. We'll increase distribution frequency, and that's in cooperation with another internal project, as I mentioned. The signing that we're doing right now is an interim measure. We are going to engage into continuous signing in a separate database, and the database will spit out small increments, IXFR increments, that we can feed into our infrastructure. We'll also publish the test program that will include an NSEC3 rollover. We are most likely not going to engage in a KSK rollover right now, but we'll definitely address operator change under DNSSEC. That's basically it. Please participate. If you have any questions, Jaap and Jim will prevent you from going to the mic, but find... Wow, that's a way of preventing everybody.
I got here first.
Okay, Jim.
Thank you, Peter. Two questions, very quick ones. First one was you mentioned three products that you used. Are they in the test bed just now, or are they being tried and rolled out and swapped out and vary between the three? You said you were using some nominum thing and Unbound and Bind9.
Oh, that's not... So we are not... We are providing the authoritative side. Yeah. These three products are the three products on the validator side that we know of.
Okay, sorry, I thought you were talking about the side.
If you have another recursive validator, you're, of course, free to participate. And okay. We would like to learn to know about that. Okay. Unfortunately, Windows isn't there yet.
Okay. Next question is, the fact you say you're using opt-out, is that an indication that perhaps if and when DE gets signed for real in production, they're going to be using opt-out, or is that too early to say at this stage?
You may well think this, but I could not possibly comment.
Lewis, I wanted to kind of ask about two things. I think you may have already answered one of them. You mentioned that you're sending 3 gigabytes to Hong Kong.
1.3, actually. That's wire format size of the zone.
Okay. Which is a lot, 1.3 or 3, big. And you mentioned signing the zone over and over again. And one thing we've been seeing is that there's been a lot of activity in signing zones by some large zones. The zone transfer system, we took for granted and find out that's actually a big bottleneck. And so I would encourage, you said you're going to start signing incrementally. That's a good thing. Start with incremental signing. Reuse signatures. Anyone who's writing their own code, reuse signatures. It's very important to not regenerate this crypto stuff over and over again, even if it's good for 30 days. You know, if it's good for 30 days, use it for 20 days. But also... the other thing, too, is to use incremental updates of things. You just make smaller changes. Don't send everything. We've seen people sometimes signing only part of the zone but sending everything anyway. So the zone transfer process, really don't take it for granted. And that's kind of like I'm just – some of the comments you made made it sound like you may have to make sure that the zone transfer process is going to work well, especially for the far distant nodes you have.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks for that clarification. So the reason is, and I agree with most all what you said, the experience to send this stuff to a far away location is kind of a self-induced pain to be prepared for the exceptional situation that we would have to transfer a zone in total, which happens every once in a while, right? Of course, the... one basic goal of going to continuous signing, having these smaller increments, and the continuous signing will, of course, introduce jitter that others have mentioned in their setups, and, of course, will reuse signatures. This kind of setup was the cheap way out, or, say, cheap way in here, because we knew we would have to improve that in the future. But, yeah, we'll definitely not rely upon AXFR for everyday production use. The way we do it today is using Unix diffs compressed. And I'd encourage everybody to sign their zone if it's big enough and then try to compress it and go back to their textbooks and learn why compressing crypto material isn't really a good way forward. So that's basically it. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Peter. We managed to run out of time for the people remote. We're not doing the IDN, but we have to do the announcement from I can already spot that. Notice that there are already three IDNs songs in production since yesterday, and still the sky didn't fall. Okay, I hope to see you all back after lunch and have a nice lunch, and then after that, a nice lunch nap. Thank you.